trouble.
And if we're not? The smart-ass first year behind me asks. I don't bother looking, but Rhiannon does, rolling her eyes as she turns back forward. Then I won't have to be concerned with learning your name, since it will be read off tomorrow morning, Dane answers with a shrug. A second year ahead of me snorts a laugh, the movement jangling two small hoop earrings in her left lobe, but the pink-haired one stays silent. Sawyer? Dane looks at the first year to my left. I'll get them there. The tall, wiry cadet, whose light complexion is covered with a smattering of freckles, answers with a tight nod. His freckled jaw ticks, and my chest pangs with sympathy. He's one of the repeats, a cadet who didn't bond during threshing and now has to start the entire year over. Get going, Dane orders, and our squad breaks apart around the same time the others do, transforming the courtyard from an orderly formation to a crowd of chatting cadets. The second and third years walk off in another direction, including Dane. We have about 20 minutes to get to class, Sawyer shouts at the eight of us first years. Fourth floor, second room on the left, in the academic wing. Get your shit and don't be late. He doesn't bother waiting to confirm we've heard him before he heads off toward the dormitory.
That has to be hard, Rhiannon says as we follow the crowd toward the dorms. Being set back and having to do this all over again?
Better than being dead, the smartass says as he passes us on the right, his dark brown hair flopping against the brown skin of his forehead with every step the shorter cadet takes. His name is Riddick, if I remember correctly from the brief introductions we went through before dinner last night. That's true, I reply as we head into the bottleneck that's formed at the door.
I overheard a third year say, when a first year survives threshing unbonded, the quadrant lets them repeat the year and try again if they want, Rhiannon adds. And I can't help but wonder how much determination it would take to survive your first year and then be willing to repeat it just for the chance you might one day become a rider. You could just as easily die the second time around.
A bird whistles to the left, and I look over the crowd, my heart leaping because I immediately recognize the tone. Dane. The call sounds again, and I narrow it down to somewhere near the door to the rotunda. He's standing at the top of the wide staircase, and the seconds our eyes lock, he motions toward the door with a subtle nod. I start saying to Rhiannon, but she's already followed my line of sight.
I'll grab your stuff and meet you there. It's under your bunk, right? She asks. You don't mind?
Your bunk is next to mine, Violet. It's not a hassle. Go!
She gives me a conspiratorial smile and shoulder bumps me.
Thank you, I smile quickly, then wade across the crowd until I break free at the edge. Lucky for me, there aren't many cadets headed into commons, which means there aren't any eyes on me once I slip inside one of the four giant doors of the rotunda.
My lungs pull in a sharp breath. It looks like the renderings I've seen in the archives. But there is no drawing, no artistic medium, that can capture just how overwhelming the space is, how exquisite every detail. The rotunda might be the most beautiful piece of architecture not only in the Citadel, but in all of Besgaeth. The room is three stories tall, from its polished marble floors to the domed glass ceiling that filters in the soft morning light. To the left are two massive arch doors to the academic wing, echoed by the same on the right, leading to the dorms. And up a half dozen steps, there are four doorways in front of me that open into the gathering hall. Equally spaced around the rotunda, shimmering in their various colors of red, green, brown, orange, blue, and black, stand six daunting marble pillars carved into dragons, as if they'd come crashing down from the ceiling above. There's enough room between the snarling mouths at the base of each to fit at least four squads in the center, but it's empty right now. I pass by the first dragon, chiseled from dark red marble, and a hand grips my elbow, pulling me back behind the pillar, where there's a gap between the claw and the wall. It's just me. Dane's voice is low and quiet as he turns me to face him. Tension radiates from every line of his frame.
I figured, since you were the one bird calling me, I grin, shaking my head.
He's been using that signal since we were kids living near the Crovelin border while our parents were stationed there with the southern wing. His brow furrows as his gaze scans over me, no doubt looking for new injuries. We only have a few minutes before this place is packed. How's your knee?
It hurts, but I'll live. I've had far worse injuries, and we both know it. But there's no use telling him to relax when he's obviously not going to.
No one tried to screw with you last night?
Concern creased his forehead, and I fold my arms to keep from smoothing the lines with my fingers. His worry sits on my chest like a stone.
Would it be so bad if they did?
I teased, forcing my smile to widen. He drops his arms to his sides and sighs so hard the sound echoes in the rotunda.
You know that's not what I mean, Violet.
No one tried to kill me last night, Dane, or even hurt me. I lean back against the wall and take some weight off my knee. Pretty sure we were all too tired and relieved to be alive to start slaughtering one another. The barracks fell quiet pretty quickly after lights out. There was something to be said for the emotional exhaustion of the day.
And you ate, right?
I know they usher you out of the dorms fast when the bells chime for six. I ate with the rest of the first years, and before you even think about lecturing me, I rewrapped my knee under my covers and had my hair braided before the bell sounded. I've been keeping scribe hours for years, Dane. They're up an hour earlier. It makes me want to volunteer for breakfast duty, actually. He glances at the tight, silver-tipped braid I've pinned into a bun against the darker hair near the crown of my head.
You should have cut it.
Don't start with me, I shake my head.
There's a reason women keep it short here, Vi. The second someone gets a hold of your hair in the sparring ring.
My hair is the least of my concerns in the sparring ring, I retort. His eyes widen.
I'm just trying to keep you safe. You're lucky I didn't shove you into Captain Fitzgibbon's hands this morning and beg him to take you out of here.
I ignore the bluster of a threat. We're wasting time, and there's one piece of information I need from Dane. Why was our squad moved from second wing to fourth yesterday? He stiffens and looks away.
Tell me. I need to know if I'm reading into a situation that doesn't exist. Fuck, he mutters, ripping his hand over his hair. Zayden Ryerson wants you dead.
It's common knowledge among the leadership cadre after yesterday. Nope, not overreacting. He moved the squad so he has a direct line to me, so he can do whatever he wants and no one will question a thing. I'm his revenge against my mother. My heart doesn't even jump at the confirmation of what I already knew. That's what I thought. I just needed to be sure my imagination wasn't running away with me.
I'm not going to let anything happen to you.
Dane steps forward and cups my face, his thumb stroking over my cheekbone in a soothing motion. There's not much you can do. I push off the wall, stepping out of his reach. I have to get to class. Already there are a few voices echoing in the rotunda as cadets pass through. His jaw works for a second, and the lines are back between his eyebrows.
Just do your best to keep a low profile, especially when we're in battle brief. Not like the colors in your hair don't give you away, but that's the one class the entire quadrant takes.
I'll see if one of the second years can stand guard. No one is going to assassinate me during history. I roll my eyes. Academics are the one place I don't have to worry. What is Zayden going to do? Pull me out of class and run me through with a sword in the middle of the hallway? Or do you honestly think he'll stab me in the middle of battle brief?
I wouldn't put it past him. He's fucking ruthless, Violet. Why do you think his dragon chose him?
The navy blue one who landed behind the dais yesterday?
My stomach twists, the way those golden eyes assessed me.
Dane nods.
Sigale is a blue dagger tail, and she's vicious.
He swallows. Don't get me wrong. Kath is a nasty piece of work when he gets riled. All red sword tails are. But even most dragons steer clear of Sigale.
I stare at Dane, at the scar that defines his jaw and the hard set of his eyes that are familiar and yet not.
What? He asks. The voices around us grow louder, and there are more footsteps coming and going.
You bonded a dragon. You have powers I don't even know about. You open doors with magic. You're a squad leader.
I say the sentences slowly, hoping they'll sink in, that I'll truly grasp how much he's changed.
It's just hard to wrap my head around you still being Dane.
I'm still me. His posture softens, and he lifts the short sleeve of his tunic, revealing the relic of a red dragon on his shoulder.
I just have this now. And as for the powers, Kath channels a pretty significant amount of magic compared to some of the other dragons, but I'm nowhere near adept at it yet. I haven't changed that much. As for lesser magic powered through the bond of my relic, I can do the typical stuff like open doors, crank up my speed, and power ink pens instead of using those inconvenient quills.
What's your signet power?
Every rider can do lesser magic once their dragon begins channeling power to them. But the signet is the unique ability that stands out, the strongest skill that results from each unique bond between dragon and rider. Some riders have the same signets. Fire wielding, ice wielding, and water wielding are just a few of the most common signet powers, all useful in battle. Then there are the signets that make a rider extraordinary. My mother can wield the power of storms. Melgrin can see the outcome of battles. I can't help but wonder again what Zayden's signet is, and if he'll use it to kill me when I least expect it.
I can read a person's recent memories, Dane admits quietly. Not like an intrinsic reads minds or anything. I have to put my hands on the person, so I'm not a security risk. But my signet's not common knowledge. I think they'll use me in intelligence.
He points to the compass patch beneath his fourth wing one on his shoulder. Wearing that sigil indicates that a signet is too classified. I just didn't notice it yesterday.
No way, I smile, taking a calming breath as I remember Zayden's uniform didn't have any patches on it.
He nods, an excited smile shaping his mouth.
I'm still learning, and of course I'm better at it the closer I am to Kath, but yeah. I just put my hands on someone's temples, and I can see what they saw. It's incredible.
That signet will more than set Dane apart. It will make him one of the most valuable interrogation tools we have.
And you say you haven't changed, I half tease.
This place can warp almost everything about a person, Vi. It cuts away the bullshit and the niceties, revealing whoever you are at your core. They want it that way. They want it to sever your previous bonds so your loyalty is to your wing. It's one of the many reasons that first years aren't allowed to correspond with their family and friends. Otherwise, you know I would have written you. But a year doesn't change that I still think of you as my best friend. I'm still Dane. And this time next year, you will still be Violet. We will still be us.
If I'm still alive, I joke as the bells ring. I have to get to class.
Yeah, and I'm going to be late to the flight field.
He motions toward the edge of the pillar.
Look, Ryerson is still a wing leader. He'll be after you. But he'll find a way to do it within the rules of the Codex, at least when people are watching.
His cheeks flush. Really good friends with Amber Mavis, the current wing leader for Third Wing, last year. And I'm telling you, the Codex is sacred to them. Now, you go first. I'll see you in the sparring gym.
He smiles reassuringly.
I'll see you, I smile back and turn on my heel, walking around the base of the massive pillar into the semi-crowded rotunda. There's a couple dozen cadets in here, walking from one building to another, and it takes a second to get my bearings. I spot the academic doors between the orange and black pillars and start that way, blending into the crowd. The hairs on the back of my neck stand up and a chill races down my spine as I cross the center of the rotunda. Then my steps halt. Cadets move around me, but my eyes are drawn upward toward the top of the steps that lead to the gathering hall.
Oh, shit.
Zayden Ryerson is watching me with narrowed eyes, the sleeves of his uniform rolled up his massive arms that remain folded across his chest, the warning in his relic-covered arm on full display as a third year next to him says something that he blatantly ignores. My heart jumps and lodges in my throat. There's maybe 20 feet between us. My fingers twitch, ready to grab one of the blades sheathed at my ribs.
Is this where he'll do it, in the middle of the rotunda?
The marble floor is gray, so it shouldn't be that hard for the staff to get the blood out. His head tilts, and he studies me with those impossibly dark eyes, like he's deciding where I'm most vulnerable. I should run, right? But at least I can see him coming if I hold this position.
His attention shifts, glancing to my right,
and he lifts a single brow at me.
My stomach pitches as Dane emerges from behind the pillar.
What are you?
Dane starts as he reaches me, his brow furrowed in confusion.
Top of the steps, fourth door,
I hiss, interrupting him. Dane's gaze snaps up as the crowd thins out around us, and he mutters a curse, not so subtly, stepping closer to me. Fewer people mean fewer witnesses, but I'm not foolish enough to think Zayden won't kill me in front of the whole quadrant if he wants.
I already knew your parents were tight, Zayden calls out, a cruel smile tilting his lips. But do you two have to be so fucking obvious?
The few cadets who are still on the rotunda turn to look at us.
Let me guess, Zayden continues, glancing between Dane and me. Childhood friends? First loves, even?
He can't hurt you without cause, right? I whisper. Without cause and calling a quorum of wing leaders because you're a squad leader. Article 4, Section 3.
Correct, Dane answers, not bothering to lower his voice. But you're not. I expected you to do a better job of hiding where your affections lie, Atos.
Zayden moves, walking down the steps.
Shit, shit, shit. Run, Violet, Dane orders me. Now!
I bolt.
Chapter 5. A quote from The Tirish Rebellion, an official brief for King Tauri by General Lilith Sorengale.
Knowing I am in direct disagreement with General Melgren's orders, I am officially objecting to the plan set forth in today's briefing. It is not this general's opinion that the children of the rebellion's leaders should be forced to witness their parents' executions. No child should watch their parent put to death.
Welcome to your first battle brief, Professor Devera says from the recessed floor of the enormous lecture hall later in the morning, a bright purple flame section patch on her shoulder matching her short hair perfectly. This is the only class held in the circular tiered room that curves the entire end of the academic hall, and one of only two rooms in the Citadel capable of fitting every cadet. Every creaky wooden seat is full, and the senior third years are standing against the walls behind us. But we all fit. It's a far cry from history last hour, where there were only three squads of first years, but at least the first years in our squad are all seated together. Now, if I could only remember all their names. Riddick is easy to remember. He cracked wise-ass comments all through history. Hopefully, he knows better than to try the same in here, though. Professor Devera isn't the joking kind.
In the past, riders have seldom been called into service before graduation, Professor Devera continues, her mouth tensing as she paces slowly in front of a 20-foot-high map of the continent mounted to the back wall that's intricately labeled with our defensive outposts along our borders. Dozens of mage lights illuminate the space, more than making up for the lack of windows and reflecting off the longsword she keeps strapped to her back.
And if they were, they were always third years who'd spent time shadowing forward wings. But we expect you to graduate with the full knowledge of what we're up against. It's not about just knowing where every wing is stationed, either. She takes her time, making eye contact with every first year she sees. The rank on her shoulder says captain, but I know she'll be a major before she leaves her rotation teaching here, given the medals pinned on her chest.
You need to understand the politics of our enemies. The strategies of defending our outposts from constant attack, and have a thorough knowledge of both recent and current battles. If you cannot grasp these basic topics, then you have no business on the back of a dragon.
She arches a black brow a few shades darker than her deep brown skin.
No pressure, Rhiannon mutters at my side, furiously taking notes.
We'll be fine, I promise her in a whisper. Third years have only been sent to Midland posts as reinforcements, never the front.
I'd kept my ears open around my mother enough to know that much. This is the only class you will have every day,
because it's the only class that will matter if you're called into service early.
Professor De Vera's gaze sweeps from left to right and pauses on me. Her eyes flare wide for a heartbeat, but she gives an approving smile and nod before moving on.
Because this class is taught every day and relies on the most current information, you will also answer to Professor Markham, who deserves nothing but your utmost respect.
She waves the scribe forward, and he moves to stand next to her, the cream color of his uniform contrasting with her stark black one. He leans in when she whispers something to him, and his thick eyebrows fly high as he whips his head in my direction. There is no approving smile when the colonel's weary eyes find mine, only a sigh that fills my chest with heavy sorrow when I hear it. I was supposed to be his star pupil in the scribe quadrant, his crowning achievement before he retires. How absolutely ironic that I am now the least likely to succeed in this one.
It is the duty of the scribes not only to study and master the past, but to relay and record the present, he says, rubbing the bridge of his bulbous nose after finally tearing his disappointed gaze from mine. Without accurate depictions of our front lines, reliable information with which to make strategic decisions, and most importantly, veracious details to document our history for the good of future generations, we are doomed, not only as a kingdom, but as a society.
Which is exactly why I've always wanted to be a scribe. Not that it matters now.
First topic of the day. Professor De Vera moves toward the map and flicks her hand, bringing a mage light directly over the eastern border with the Poromiel province of Breivik. The eastern wing experienced an attack last night near the village of Shakir by a drift of Bravey griffins and riders.
Oh, shit. A murmur rips through the hall and I dip my quill into the ink pot on the desk in front of me so I can take notes. I can't wait to channel so I can use the type of coveted pens Mom keeps on her desk. A smile curves my lips. There could definitely be perks to being a writer. There will be.
Naturally, some information is redacted for security purposes. But what we can tell you is that the wards faltered along the top of the Espen Mountains.
Professor De Vera pulls her hands apart and the light expands, illuminating the mountains that form our border with Breivik,
allowing the drift not only to enter Navarian territory, but for their riders to channel and wield sometime around midnight.
My stomach sinks as a murmur rises from the cadets, especially the first years. Dragons aren't the only animals capable of channeling powers to their riders. Griffins from Poromiel also share the ability, but dragons are the only ones capable of powering the wards that make all other magic but their own impossible within our borders. They're the reason Navarre's borders are somewhat circular. Their power radiates from the veil and can only extend so far, even with squads stationed at every outpost. Without those wards, we're fucked. It would be open season on Navarian villages when the raiding parties from Poromiel inevitably descend.
Those greedy assholes are never content with the resources they have. They always want ours, too. And until they learn to be content with our trade agreements, we have no chance of ending conscription in Navarre.
But if we're not on high alert, then they must have gotten the wards rewoven, or at least stabilized.
37 civilians were killed in the attack in the hour before a squad from the eastern wing could arrive, but the riders and dragons managed to repel the drift.
Professor De Vera finishes, folding her arms over her chest.
Based on that information, what questions would you ask?
She holds up a finger.
I only want answers from first years to start.
My initial question would be why the hell the wards faltered. But it's not like they're going to answer a question like that in a room full of cadets with zero security clearance. I study the map. The Espen mountain range is the highest along our eastern border with Breivik, making it the least likely place for an attack, especially since griffins don't tolerate altitude nearly as well as dragons. probably due to the fact that they're half lion, half eagle and can't handle the thinner air at higher altitudes. There's a reason we've been able to fend off every major assault on our territory for the last 600 years, and we've successfully defended our land in this never-ending 400-year-long war. Our abilities, both lesser and signet, are superior because our dragons can channel more power than griffins. So why attack in that mountain range? What caused the wards to falter there?
Come on, first years, show me you have more than just good balance. Show me you have the critical thinking skills to be here, Professor DeVera demands. It's more important than ever that you're ready for what's beyond our borders.
Is this the first time the wards have faltered? A first year a couple of rows ahead asks.
Professors DeVera and Markham share a look before she turns toward the cadet. No. My heart jolts into my throat and the room falls pin drop quiet. It's not the first time. The girl clears her throat.
And how often are they faltering?
Professor Markham's shrewd eyes narrow on her.
That's above your pay grade, cadet.
He turns his attention to our section.
Next relevant question to the attack we're discussing.
How many casualties did the wing suffer?
A first year down the row to my right asks.
One injured dragon, one dead rider.
Another murmur rises from the hall. Surviving graduation doesn't mean we'll survive service. Statistically, most riders die before retirement age, especially at the rate riders have been falling over the last 2 years.
Why would you ask that particular question?
Professor DeVera asks the cadet.
To know how many reinforcements they'll need, he answers.
Professor DeVera nods, turning toward Pryor, the meekest first year in our squad, who has his hand up, but he lowers it quickly, scrunching his dark eyebrows.
Did you want to ask a question?
Yes, he nods, sending a few locks of black hair into his eyes, then shakes his head.
No, never mind. So decisive.
Luca, the catty first year in our squad, I'll do just about anything to avoid, mocks from next to him, tilting her head as cadets laugh around them. A corner of her mouth tilts up into a smirk, and she flips her long brown hair over her shoulder in a move that's anything but casual.
Like me, she's one of the few women in the quadrant who didn't cut her hair.
I envy her confidence that it won't be used against her, but not her attitude. And I've known her less than a day.
He's in our squad.
Orally, at least I think that's her name, chastises, her no-nonsense black eyes narrowing on Luca.
Show some loyalty.
Please, no dragon is bonding to a guy who can't even decide if he wants to ask a question. And did you see him at breakfast this morning? He held up the entire line because he couldn't choose between bacon or sausage. Luca rolls her coal-rimmed eyes.
If Fourth Wing is done picking at one another, Professor DeVera asks, lifting a brow.
Ask what altitude the village is at, I whisper to Rhiannon.
What?
Her brow furrows.
Just ask,
I reply, trying to keep Dane's advice in mind. I swear I can feel him staring at the back of my neck from seven rows behind me. But I'm not going to turn and look, not when I know Zayden's up there somewhere, too.
What altitude is the village at? Rhiannon asks.
Professor DeVera's eyebrows rise as she turns to Rhiannon.
Markham?
A little less than 10,000 feet,
he answers.
Why?
Rhiannon darts a dose of side-eye at me and clears her throat.
Just seems a little high for a planned attack with griffins.
Good job, I whisper.
It is a little high for a planned attack, DeVera says.
Why don't you tell me why that's bothersome, Cadet Sorengale? And maybe you'd like to ask your own questions from here on out?
She levels a stare on me that has me squirming in my seat.
Every head in the room turns in my direction. If anyone had an inkling of doubt about who I am, it's long gone now.
Awesome.
Griffins aren't as strong at that altitude, and neither is their ability to channel, I say. It's an illogical place for them to attack unless they knew the wards would fail, especially since the village looks to be about, what, an hour's flight from the nearest outpost? I glance at the map to be sure I'm not making a fool of myself. That is Shaker right there, isn't it?
Scribe's training for the win.
It is. A corner of Professor DeVera's mouth lifts into a smirk. Keep going with that line of thought.
Wait a second.
Didn't you say it took an hour for the squad of riders to arrive? My gaze narrows.
I did. She looks at me with expectation.
Then they were already on their way, I blurt, immediately recognizing how silly that sounds. My cheeks heat as a mumble of laughter sounds around me.
Yeah, because that makes sense. Jack turns around in his seat from the front row and openly laughs at me. General Melgren knows the outcome of a battle before it happens, but even he doesn't know when it will happen, dumbass.
I feel the chuckling of my classmates reverberate in my bones. I want to crawl under this ridiculous desk and disappear.
Fuck off, Barlow, Rhiannon snaps. I'm not the one who thinks precognition is a thing.
He retorts with a sneer.
Gods help us if that one ever gets on the back of a dragon.
Another round of laughter has my neck flaming too.
Why do you think that, Violet? Professor Markham winces. Cadet Zorengale.
Because there's no logical way they can get there within an hour of the attack unless they were already on their way, I argue, shooting a glare at Jack. Fuck him and his laughter. I might be weaker than he is, but I'm a hell of a lot smarter.
It would take at least half that long to light the beacons in the range and call for help, and no full squad is sitting around just waiting to be needed. More than half those riders would have been asleep, which means they were already on their way.
And why would they already be on their way?
Professor DeVera prods, and the light in her eyes tells me I'm right, giving me the confidence to take my train of thought a step further.
Because they somehow knew the wards were breaking.
I lift my chin, simultaneously hoping I'm right and praying to Dune, the goddess of war, that I'm wrong.
That's the most, Jack starts.
She's right, Professor DeVera interrupts, and a hush falls over the room. One of the dragons in the wing sensed the faltering ward, and the wing flew. Had they not, the casualties would have been far higher, and the destruction of the village much worse. A little bubble of confidence rises in my chest, which is promptly popped by Jack's glare, telling me he hasn't forgotten his promise to kill me.
Second and third years take over, Professor DeVera orders. Let's see if you can be a little more respectful to your fellow cadets.
She arches a brow at Jack as questions begin to fire off from the riders behind us. How many riders were deployed to the site? What killed the lone fatality? How long did it take to clear the village of the griffins? Were any left alive for questioning? I write down every question and answer, my mind organizing the facts into what kind of report I would have filed if I'd been in the scribe quadrant, which information was important enough to include, and what was extraneous.
What was the condition of the village? A deep voice asks from the back of the lecture hall.
The hairs on my neck rise, my body recognizing the imminent threat behind me.
Ryerson? Markham asks, shielding his eyes from the mage lights as he looks toward the top of the hall. The village, Zayden restates. Professor DeVera said the damage would have been worse. But what was the actual condition? Was it burned? Destroyed? They wouldn't demolish it if they were trying to establish a foothold, so the condition of the village matters when trying to determine a motive for the attack.
Professor DeVera smiles in approval.
The buildings they'd already gone through were burned, and the rest were being looted when the wing arrived. They were looking for something,
Zayden says with complete conviction. And it wasn't riches. That's not a gem mining district. Which begs the question, what do we have that they want so badly?
Exactly. That's the question.
Professor De Vera glances around the room.
And that right there is why Ryerson is a wing leader. You need more than strength and courage to be a good rider.
So what's the answer? A first year to the left asks.
We don't know, Professor De Vera answers with a shrug. It's just another piece in the puzzle of why our constant bids for peace are rejected by the kingdom of Poromil. What were they looking for? Why that village? Were they responsible for the collapse of the ward? Or was it already faltering? Tomorrow, next week, next month, there will be another attack. And maybe we'll get another clue. Go to history if you're looking for answers. Those wars have already been dissected and examined. Battle Brief is for fluid situations. In this class, we want you to learn which questions to ask so all of you have a chance at coming home alive.
Something in her tone tells me it's not just third years who might be called into service this year. And a chill settles in my bones.
You seriously knew every answer in history and apparently every right question to ask in Battle Brief, Rhiannon says, shaking her head as we stand on the sidelines of the sparring mat after lunch, watching Riddick and Orally circle each other in their fighting leathers. They're evenly matched in size. Riddick is on the smaller side, and Orally is built just like Mira, which doesn't surprise me because she's a legacy on her father's side.
You're not even going to have to study for tests, are you?
The rest of the first years stand on our side, but the second and third years line the others. They're definitely at an advantage here, considering they've already had at least a year of combat training.
I was training to be a scribe, I shrug, and the vest Mira made me shimmers slightly with the movement. Other than the times the scales catch the light under the camouflaging mesh, it fits right in with the tops we've been given from Central Issue yesterday. All the women are dressed similarly now, though the cuts of their leathers are chosen by preference. The guys are mostly shirtless because they think shirts give their opponent something to grab onto. Personally, I'm not arguing with their logic, just enjoying the view. Respectfully, of course, which means keeping my eyes on my own squad's mat and off the other 20 mats and the massive gym that consumes the first floor of the academic wing. One wall is made entirely of windows and doors, all left open to let in the breeze. But it's still stiflingly hot. Sweat trickles down my spine under my vest. There are three squads from each wing here this afternoon. And lucky me, First Wing has sent their third squads, which include Jack Barlow, who's been glaring at me from two mats over since I walked in.
Guess that means you're not worried about academics, Rhiannon says, her brows rising at me.
She's chosen a leather vest, too. But hers cuts in above the collarbone and secures at her neck, leaving her shoulders bare for movement.
Stop circling each other like your dance partners and attack, Professor Amaterio orders from across the mat, where Dane watches Orally and Riddick's match with our squad executive leader, Sienna.
Thank God Dane's shirt is on, because I don't need another distraction when it's time for my turn.
I'm worried about this, I tell Rhiannon, tilting my chin toward the mat.
Really? She shoots me a skeptical look. Her braids are twisted into a small bun at the nape of her neck.
I figured as a Sorengil, you'd be a hand-to-hand threat.
Not exactly. At my age, Mira had been training in hand-to-hand for 12 years. I have a whopping 6 months under my belt, which wouldn't matter as much if I wasn't as breakable as a porcelain teacup. But here we are.
Riddick launches toward Orally, but she ducks, sweeping out her leg and tripping him. He staggers but doesn't go down. He pivots quickly, palming a dagger in his hand.
No blades today, Professor Amaterio bellows from beside the mat.
He's only the fourth professor I've met, but he's definitely the one who intimidates me most. Or maybe it's just the subject he teaches that has me envisioning his compact frame as giant.
We're just assessing.
Riddick grumbles and sheathes his knife just in time to deflect a right hook from Orly.
The brunette packs a punch, Rhiannon says with an appreciative smile before glancing my way.
What about you? I ask as Riddick lands a jab to Orly's ribs.
Shit!
He shakes his head and backs up a step. I don't want to hurt you. Orly holds her ribs but lifts her chin.
Who said you hurt me?
Pulling your punches does her a disservice, Dane says, folding his arms. The Signes on the northeast border aren't going to give her any quarter because she's a woman if she falls from her dragon behind enemy lines, Riddick. They'll kill her just the same.
Let's go,
Orly shouts, beckoning Riddick by curling her fingers. It's obvious that most cadets have trained their whole lives to enter the quadrant, especially Orly, who slips a jab from Riddick and twists to land a quick tap to his kidneys.
Ouch. I mean, damn,
Rhiannon mutters, giving Orly another look before turning back to me.
I'm pretty good on the mat. My village is on the Signesan border, so we all learn to defend ourselves fairly young. Physics and math aren't problems either. But history? She shakes her head. That class might be the death of me.
They don't kill you for failing history, I say, as Riddick charges Orly, taking her to the mat with enough force to make me wince. I'm probably going to die on these mats. She hooks her legs around his and somehow leverages him over until she's the one on top, landing punch after punch to the side of his face. Blood spatters the mat.
I could probably offer some tips to survive combat training, Sawyer says from Rhiannon's other side,
running his hand over a day's growth of brown stubble that doesn't quite cover his freckles. History isn't my strongest subject, though. A tooth goes flying and bile rises in my throat.
Enough, Professor Emeterio shouts.
Orly rolls off Riddick and stands, touching her fingers to her split lip and examining the blood, then offers her hand to help him up. He takes it.
Sienna, take Orly to the healers. No reason to lose a tooth during assessment, Emeterio orders.
I'll make you a deal, Rhiannon says, locking her brown eyes with mine. Let's help each other out. We'll help you with hand to hand if you help us with history.
Sound like a deal, Sawyer?
Absolutely.
Deal, I swallow as one of the third years wipes down the mat with a towel. But I think I'm getting the better end of that.
You haven't seen me try to memorize dates, Rhiannon jokes.
A couple of mats over, someone shrieks and we all turn to look. Jack Barlow has another first year in a headlock. The other guy is smaller, thinner than Jack, but still has a good 50 pounds on me. Jack yanks his arms, his hands still secure around the other man's head.
That guy is such an ass.
Rhiannon starts. The sickening crack of bones breaking sounds across the gym, and the first year goes limp in Jack's hold.
Sweet Malik, I whisper, as Jack drops the man to the ground.
I'm starting to wonder if the god of death lives here for how often his name must be invoked. My lunch threatens to reappear, but I breathe in through my nose and out through my mouth, since it's not like I can shove my head between my knees here.
What did I say? Their instructor shouts as he charges onto the mat. You broke his damn neck! How was I supposed to know his neck was that weak? Jack argues. You're dead, Sorengale, and I'm going to be the one to kill you.
His promise from yesterday slithers through my memory.
Eyes forward,
Emeterio orders, but his tone is kinder than it has been as we all look away from the dead first year.
You don't have to get used to it, he tells us, but you do have to function through it. You and you.
He points to Rhiannon and another first year in our squad, a man with a stocky build, blue-black hair, and angular features.
Shit, I can't remember his name.
Trevor? Thomas, maybe? There are too many new people to remember who's who at this point.
I glance at Dane, but he's watching the pair as they take the mat. Rhiannon makes quick work of the first year, stunning me every time she dodges a punch and lands one of her own. She's fast, and her hits are powerful, the kind of lethal combination that will set her apart, just like Mira.
"Do you yield?" she asks the first-year guy when she takes him to his back, her hand stopped mid-hit, just above his throat.
Tanner? I'm pretty sure it's something that starts with a T.
"No!"
he shouts, hooking his legs around Rhiannon's and slamming her to her back. But she rolls and quickly gains her feet before putting him in the same position again, this time with her boot to his neck.
"I don't know, Tynan, you might want to yield," Dane says with a grin. "She's handing you your ass."
Ah, that's right. Tynan.
"Fuck off, Atos!"
Tynan snaps, but Rhiannon presses her boot into his throat, garbling the last word. He turns a mottled shade of red. Yeah, Tynan has more ego than common sense.
"He yields,"
Emeterio calls out, and Rhiannon steps back, offering her hand. Tynan takes it.
"You,"
Emeterio points to the pink-haired second year with the rebellion relic.
"And you,"
his finger swings to me. She's at least a head taller than me, and if the rest of her body is as toned as her arms, then I'm pretty much fucked. I can't let her get her hands on me. My heart threatens to beat out of my chest, but I nod and step onto the mat.
"You've got this," Rhiannon says, tapping my shoulder as she passes me.
"Soren Gale." The pink-haired girl looks me over like I'm something she scraped off the side of her boot, narrowing her pale green eyes.
"You really should dye your hair if you don't want everyone to know who your mother is. You're the only silver-haired freak in the quadrant."
"Never said I cared if everyone knows who my mother is." I circle the second year on the mat. "I am proud of her service to protect our kingdom from enemies both without and within." As her jaw tightens at the dig, a bubble of hope rises in my chest. Marked ones, as I'd heard some people this morning refer to those carrying rebellion relics on their arms. Blame my mother for the execution of their parents. Fine, hate me. Mom often says the minute you let emotion enter a fight, you've already lost. I've never prayed harder that my ice in her veins mother was right.
"You bitch," she seethes. "Your mother murdered my family."
She lunges forward and swings wildly, and I quickly sidestep, spinning away with my hands up. We do that for a few more rounds, and I land a few jabs, start to think that my plan might just work. She growls low in her throat as she misses me again, and her foot flies at my head. I easily duck, but then she drops to the ground and kicks out with her other foot, which lands square in my chest, sending me backward. I hit the mat with a thud, and she's already above me, so damn fast.
"You can't use your powers in here, Imogen," Dane shouts.
Imogen is trying her best to kill me. Her eyes are above mine, and I feel the quick slide of something hard against my ribs as she smiles at me. But her smile fades as we both look down, and I can't help but notice a dagger being resheathed. The armor just saved my life. "Thank you, Mira." Confusion mars Imogen's face for just a second, long enough for me to send my fist into her cheek and roll out from under her. My hand screams with pain, even though I'm sure I formed the fist right, but I blocked it out as we both gain our feet.
"What kind of armor is that?"
she asks, staring at my ribs as we circle each other.
"Mine!" I duck and dodge as she comes at me again, but her movements are a blur. "Imogen!" Emeterio shouts. "Do it again, and I'll..."
I swerve the wrong way this time, and she catches me, taking me to the floor. The mat smacks my face, and her knee digs into my back as she pulls my right arm behind me.
"Yield!"
she shouts. I can't. If I yield on the first day, what will the second bring?
"No!"
Now I'm the one lacking common sense like Tynan, and I'm far more breakable.
She pulls my arm farther, and pain consumes every thought, blackening the edges of my vision. I cry out as the ligaments stretch, shred, then pop. "Yield, Violet!" Dane yells. "Yield!" Imogen demands. Gasping for breath against the weight of her on my back, I turn my face to the side as she wrenches my shoulder apart, the pain consuming me. "She yields," Emeterio says. "That's enough." I hear it again, the macabre sound of snapping bone. But this time, it's mine.
Chapter 6. A quote from Major Frederick's Modern Guide for Healers.
"It is my opinion that of all the signet powers riders provide, mending is the most precious, but we cannot allow ourselves to become complacent when in the company of such a signet, for menders are rare, and the wounded are not."
Flames of agony engulf my upper arm and chest as Dane carries me through the lower, covered passage out of the rider's quadrant, over the ravine, and into the healer quadrant. It's basically a stone bridge covered and sided with more stone, which pretty much makes it a suspended tunnel with a few windows. But I'm not thinking clearly enough to take it in as we rush through, his strides eating up the distance.
"Almost there,"
he reassures me, his grip firm but careful on my ribcage and beneath my knees as my useless arm rests on my chest.
"Everyone saw you lose it,"
I whisper, doing my best to mentally block the pain like I have countless times before. It's usually as easy as building a mental wall around the pulsing torment in my body, then telling myself the pain only exists in that box so I can't feel it. But it isn't working so well this time.
"I didn't lose it," he kicks the door 3 times when we reach it.
"You shouted and carried me out of there like I mean something to you." I focus on the scar on his jaw, the stubble on his tan skin, anything to keep from feeling the utter destruction in my shoulder.
"You do mean something to me,"
he kicks again. And now everyone knows. The door swings open, and Winifred, a healer who has been at my side too many times to mention, stands back so Dane can carry me in.
"Another injury. You riders certainly are trying to fill our beds to—"
Oh no.
"Violet?"
Her eyes fly wide. "Hi, Winifred," I manage over the pain.
"This way."
She leads us into the infirmary, a long hall of beds, half of which are full of people in rider black. Healers do not have magic, relying on traditional tinctures and medical training to heal as best they can. But menders do. Hopefully, Nolan's around tonight since he's been mending me for the last 5 years. The signet of mending is exceptionally rare among riders. They have the power to fix, to restore, to return anything to its original state, from ripped cloth to pulverized bridges, including broken human bones. My brother Brennan was a mender, and would have become one of the greatest had he lived. Dane gently lays me onto the bed Winifred brings us to. Then she leans into the edge of the mattress, near my hip. Every creased line in her face is a comfort as she strokes a weathered hand across my forehead.
"Helen, go get Nolan,"
Winifred orders a healer in her 40s walking by.
"No!"
Dane barks, panic lacing his tone. "Excuse me?" The middle-aged healer glances between Dane and Winifred, clearly torn.
"Helen, this is Violet Sorengale. And if Nolan finds out she was here and you didn't call him, well, that's on you,"
Winifred says in a deceptively calm tenor.
"Sorengale,"
the healer repeats, her voice rising. I try to focus on Dane through the throbbing in my shoulder, but the room is starting to spin. I want to ask him why wouldn't he want my shoulder mended, but another wave of pain threatens to pull me into unconsciousness, and all I can do is moan.
"Get Nolan or he will let his dragon eat you alive, sour face and all, Helen."
Winifred arches a silver eyebrow as she ignores Dane, insisting again not to call the mender. The woman blanches and disappears.
Dane pulls a wooden chair closer to my bed, and it scrapes the floor with a god-awful sound.
Violet, I know you're hurting, but maybe...
Maybe what, Dane Atos? You want to see her suffer? Winifred lectures.
I told her they'd break you.
She mutters as she leans over me, her gray eyes full of worry as she assesses me. Winifred is the best healer Bezgaeth has, and she prepares every tonic she prescribes herself, and has seen me through more scrapes than I care to count over the years.
Would she listen to me? Absolutely not. Your mother is so damned stubborn.
She reaches for my injured arm, and I wince as she raises it a couple of inches, prods my shoulder.
Well, that's certainly broken,
Winifred tisks, raising her brows at the sight of my arm. And it looks like we need a surgeon for that shoulder. What's happened? She asks Dane.
Sparring, I explain in one word.
You hush. Save your energy. Winifred looks back at Dane.
Make yourself useful, boy, and pull the curtain around us. The fewer people who see her injured, the better.
He jumps to his feet and quickly complies, drawing the blue fabric around us to make a small but effective room, separating us from the other riders who have been brought in.
Drink this. Winifred brings out a vial of amber liquid from her belt. It will handle the pain while we get you sorted. You can't ask him to mend her, Dane protests as she uncorks the glass. The pair of us have been mending her for the past 5 years, she lectures, bringing the vial closer. Don't start telling me what I can and cannot do.
Dane slides one hand under my back, the other under my head, helping me slightly upright so I can get the liquid down. It's bitter, like always, as I swallow, but I know it will do the trick. He settles me back on the bed and turns to Winifred.
I don't want her in pain. That's why we're here. But if she's injured this severely, surely we can see if the scribes will take her as a late admission. It's only been a day.
As his reasoning for not wanting a mender sinks in, my anger is able to pierce through the pain long enough for me to bite out.
I'm not going to the scribes.
Then I sigh, closing my eyes as a pleasant hum races through my veins. Soon there's enough distance between me and the pain to think somewhat clearly as I force my eyes open again. At least I think it's soon. But there's a conversation going on I clearly haven't been paying attention to, so it's obviously been a few minutes. The curtain whips back and Nolan walks in, leaning heavily on his cane. He smiles at his wife, his bright white teeth contrasting his brown skin.
You sent for me, my...
His smile falters as he sees me.
Violet?
Hi, Nolan.
I force my mouth to curve upward.
I'd wave, but one of my arms doesn't work, and the other feels really heavy.
Good gods, am I slurring my words? Legeus serum, Winifred offers her husband a crooked smile.
She's with you, Dane?
Nolan turns an accusing look on Dane, and I feel all of 15 years old again, being hauled in because I broke my ankle while we were climbing somewhere we shouldn't have been.
I'm her squad leader, Dane replies, scooting out of Nolan's way so the mender can get closer. Putting her under my command was the only thing I could think of to keep her safe.
Not doing such a good job, are you?
Nolan's eyes narrow.
It was assessment day for hand-to-hand, Dane explains. Imogen, she's a second year, dislocated Violet's shoulder and broke her arm. On assessment day? Nolan growls, cutting away the fabric of my short-sleeved shirt with his dagger.
The man is 84 if he's a day, and he still dresses in rider black, sheathed with all his weapons.
Her mother was one of Fen Ryerson's separatists,
I explain slowly, trying to enunciate and failing.
And I'm a Soringale, so I get it.
I don't, Nolan grumbles. I've never agreed with the way they've conscripted those kids to the Riders Quadrant as punishment for the sins of their parents.
We have never forced conscripts into that quadrant, ever. And for a very good reason. Most cadets don't survive, which was likely the point, I suspect. Regardless, you certainly shouldn't have to suffer for the honor of your mother. General Sorengil saved Navarre by capturing the Great Betrayer.
So you won't mend her, right?
Dane asks softly so he can't be heard outside the curtain.
I'm just asking that the healers do their work and let nature take the time it needs. No magic. She doesn't stand a chance if she goes back in there in a cast or has to defend herself while her shoulder heals from reconstruction surgery. The last one took her 4 months. This is our chance to get her out of the Rider's Quadrant while she's still breathing.
I'm not going to the Sibes.
So much for not slurring.
Sibes.
I try again.
Sibes.
Oh, fuck it.
Mend me.
I will always mend you, Nolan promises.
Just this once.
I concentrate on every word.
If the others see I need mending all the time, they'll think I'm weak.
Which is why we have to use this opportunity to get you out.
Panic rises in Dane's voice and my heart sinks. He can't protect me from everything, and watching me break, watching me eventually die is going to ruin him.
Walking out of here and going straight to the Scribe Quadrant is your best chance at survival.
I glare at Dane and choose my words carefully.
I'm not leaving the Riders just so Mom can throw me back. I'm staying.
I turn my head and the room spins as I look for Nolan.
Mend me, but just once.
You know it's going to hurt like hell and will still ache for a couple of weeks, right?
Nolan asks.